Great leadership is about principles. From our work with hundreds of school leaders, it is clear that those who understand this are the ones who thrive. At Making Stuff Better, we create regenerative spaces. Whether these be through executive coaching, coach training, or our group programs, one principle is clear. The principle of belonging comes up time and time again. So with this in mind, here at Making Stuff Better, we are making 2023 the year of belonging. This show is a series of journeys we will take to explore what belonging means in an international school in the 21st century. What does it feel like? How do you create it? What matters most about it? And do we even need it at all in our schools? Join us as we discuss leadership stories from around the globe and uncover what belonging means today and why leaders may need it to thrive. By me, Matt Hall, and my friend and colleagues, Jill Kelly and Naomi Ward. Powered by Making Stuff Better.
Right, well, welcome folks to another edition of Principled. And yeah, I'm really excited today. I feel like we've got a queue because today we're joined by Owen Eastwood, who is the author of Belonging, which I know many of you will have read and be familiar with, but you know, kind of international bestseller on what it means to belong and what in our past can help us to bring togetherness to what we do. I don't know if I can do a decent enough introduction, Owen, so I'm going to ask you to introduce yourself.
Well, lovely to be with you too today. I'm a performance coach, first of all, so it's my job. And my specialism is helping leaders, and actually mainly in the corporate sector, but more well-known in sports, to create the best possible environment to achieve what they have set as their goal. And a huge part of creating the best environment for people to flourish in is making sure they all have a sense of belonging, feel included and part of it rather than excluded and outside of it. So yeah, that's hence was a reason for writing the book Belonging. Before that, I was a lawyer for 15 years and I was a partner in a London city law firm. So I had a bit of a strange transition in careers, but one I'm grateful for. And you know, you can probably tell by my accent, I'm a New Zealander, but I have been living in the UK for most of the last 20 years.
Great. Well, thanks for being here. And let's kick off with that question you touched upon there, which is, yeah, why does belonging matter?
Belonging actually has an absolutely profound impact on people's hormonal state and their mindset and their behavior. So actually it comes from our evolutionary story that for, I would say, 100% of our history, if you did not belong to a group of people, you would not survive. And people might think, well, okay, I can understand that historically, but how's that relevant today? The statistics show that people who feel socially isolated and don't feel they belong to a group of people are four times more likely to have mental health issues and four times more likely to have cardiovascular issues. So I actually don't, I think it is something that continues that we need belonging in order to survive. So from a well-being point of view, it's really quite critical. Also from a performance point of view, when people feel they belong, you can actually measure it hormonally. You will see that their stress hormones, their cortisol levels, even adrenaline will be reduced, and other energizing, sustainable hormones such as dopamine, oxytocin rise. Now, in performance, we want people to be energized positively in that way. We don't want to be energized just by fear, stress. We want them to be energized positively through dopamine, you know, working hard towards something, and oxytocin, feeling connected and trusting with other people around them. So it's absolutely, from a performance and a well-being point of view, a critical element.
And I know in the book you've done a really deep dive into this, particularly looking at where it's existed in ancient cultures. I'm just curious if you could expand a little bit on that in terms of your findings and the extent to which we've been aspiring to belonging for such a long time.
Well, everybody listening to this will intuitively know that they feel better, they have better experiences, they perform better when they feel they belong with a group of people rather than they feel they don't belong there. Okay, so it's always been part of the human story. And our ancestors actually didn't have technology in the way that we do, that's for sure. They didn't have strategists and big strategies, did they? They actually had a less complicated world in many ways, and therefore they understood for them to be successful, did require everybody to have a sense of belonging and togetherness. That was the only way you were going to be able to work together and achieve the basics of sustaining life. Now we think we're a bit cleverer than that. We actually downplay the role of human beings, and we think that we can get there with amazing strategy and great technology, and that's just not true. So I think in many ways our ancestors were a lot smarter than us. And when I was, you know, my background is I'm part English, part Maori, the indigenous people of New Zealand, and part Irish. And when I was five, as I tell the story in my book, my father died very suddenly. And he was an only child, but he was half English and half Maori. And I found becoming a teenager quite a frustrating process in terms of trying to find my own identity. You know, I didn't have him to inform me about what it was to be part of the English tribe or the Maori tribe. And I and my siblings sort of were able to cope with that and create their own identity story, but I wasn't, because I knew I belonged somewhere, but I knew I also wasn't there. So when I was 12, I wrote a letter to the Maori tribe that we're affiliated to, and I just said, you know, my name's Owen Eastwood, my father was Harry Eastwood, his mother, my grandmother's Rose Eastwood, and that's really all I know about our connection. And they wrote this very, very powerful letter back, which said, Owen, we know who you are, and you belong here. And then they proceeded to share 1,000 years of my ancestors, their names and stories. Quite interestingly, mostly highlighting female ancestors, because actually their stories were more epic. And again, I tell the one of my grandmother 4 generations ago, Pakanui, I write about her in the book. And they also explain this ancient idea in Polynesia, but I've spoken all around the world, and people tell me this is really a universal way of understanding belonging. And that was, they explained to me, this 12-year-old boy, that the way you need to see yourself in this world is that for every community that you belong to, your family, your school, your nation, the sports team, whatever, that you are one person in a line of people with your arms interlocked with each other. And that line of people goes right back to our origin story. You know, that could be the start of a school, could be the start of a nation, whatever community you're thinking about. And but you're also part of this line of people that go into the future to the end of time. And the metaphor they used was the sun first shone on our founders and on our origin story, and slowly moves down this line, revealing all of us in turn. So when the sun is on you, you're alive. That's your moment. What you do will be a chapter of the story that is written, okay? So it's important. But the fact of the matter was, you are always being part of this line of people. And when the sun moves off you, whether you go to another school or whether you actually die in life, you will still remain this unbreakable bond of belonging with all these other people. And it's an amazing way to give people quite, I had quite a euphoric sense of belonging when, as a 12-year-old, these people took time to explain to me that you might feel isolated and frustrated as a kid. You're not. You profoundly belong to every community you're part of.
It's an incredibly moving story, and I sort of wonder what became possible for that 12-year-old boy hearing that connection.
Yeah. Life-changing for me.
And reading your book and hearing you now, it feels like there's a belonging mindset almost with that image of the sun. There's this sense of humility and also a sense of looking at the past, which is not something that we naturally gravitate towards in terms of that origin story. So am I hearing that right? You know, mindset of storytelling and humility, actually, that we're only here for our moment.
Absolutely. And that in that frame of, you know, the Polynesian idea of waka papa, it was also explained to me that this is defines how we think about culture. And so the work that I do with leaders is based on that ancient idea. Everything we do is built out from that. So to answer your question, the way we think about leading is that when the sun is shining on us, when it's our moment, we are the guardians of what has come before us. And again, if we take it into the school context, you know, the school didn't start this year. You know, it didn't start when I was appointed head teacher. This is a story that precedes me. So what I was taught was that what's important is that you understand exactly what you are inheriting and you act as a guardian of it. But importantly, that is not to create a fairy tale around it, fixed, sometimes less so. So that is part of understanding the past. It's not just a story, and it's not, you know, certainly not there just for a ritualistic entertainment. It's actually very informative. We want the wisdom and the experiences to be passed down, but we need to understand what our roles of guardians are. And then when the sun's shining on us, that moment is the present. So what is the moment requiring of us? It may require something of us that we actually don't particularly want to do. It might be very, very hard. And we might have seen our ancestors before who flourished and actually were able to have a fantastic life for years and years, but the moment may not be demanding that of us. So do we have the courage and the foresight to do what is required, or do we want to sort of be blind to it and just pass it on to the next generation? And that's the third part, is the future. And what we were taught was that everything you do has to allow, enable the people who follow you to thrive. So you're not allowed to make decisions which may fix something or may address something today, but ultimately will reduce the opportunity of those who follow. So that whole ancient idea actually is extremely relevant today in my mind, and certainly in my coaching, as to what a good culture looks like. And, you know, our identity is tying together the past, the present, and the future. I mean, that is the same with every human being as well. You can't have an identity story which just started today. It doesn't work like that. We're projecting forward what we want our life to be, and we're informed by what's happened before.
If we don't acknowledge what's in the past, and I'm curious about how you do that when events have happened that are not a romantic story.
Yeah.
They need to be addressed. And I know you work with the South African rugby team, but I wonder if there's any other example of how a story has been kind of healing or...
Yes. Yeah. Well, I give you a dramatic example, really. I work with one of the biggest businesses in the world. I work with a global leadership team. And we actually did a quite amazing experience reflecting on the whakapapa of the business, you know. And again, it's an iconic business. And we actually, it was in New York, and we had this sort of, we sort of had different parts. It was like a set up like a museum, basically. We went through the different decades of the business. And, you know, there are a lot of things that they invented which are now ubiquitous. So it was a pretty inspiring story. We got to the end of the story, and then we had these lights shining on us now. So it's now our time to write the next chapter of the story. And we asked the question, is there anything that needs to be mended or fixed? Because it's a pretty amazing story. And some of the female leaders put their hand up and said that the way women have been treated here for decades has to stop right now. Some of the behaviors, some of the limitations put on them, some of the barriers that exist here. So we need to call this out. And they did that, articulated that. It was complete consensus that was true. And then there's a recommitment made by that leadership team that those will be addressed, similarly around diversity and inclusion. So that's a good example. You know, it wasn't a big fairy tale. I mean, there were some amazing things, but that's not what's required to be good leaders today. Is to create fairy tales. We should celebrate the amazing things that we've inherited, but we need to have the courage to stand up to what is needing to be fixed in order to unleash the next generation. And obviously, gender discrimination's shocking from a performance point of view.
What's the option when you maybe are in a startup, you know, you're in a new school or a school that doesn't have a long history?
But that's just as exciting, because you get to curate your origin story, and that just sends ripples out for the years and the people who will follow. So, you know, it's a lot of businesses, schools, teams, they don't have much intent around the origin story. It just sort of happens. I can't tell you how many businesses I've met who have told me, you know, we're super successful, we've done incredibly well, we've never really thought about our culture, never really thought about belonging, never really thought about people having a sense of inclusion, but now we want to fix it. Okay, and that's tricky, very, very difficult and complicated to do that once you're a long way down the path. But if you start off as a new school with this really clear intent about this is the identity that we will have, These are the values that we will all guide us. This is our vision of what a spectacular success would look like. This is a relationship we want to have with our community that we live in. Bring in rituals as well. All of these things, just an amazing opportunity. And, you know, when you know that that has always been the way somewhere, you know, that's very inspiring later. You know, you're not having to find yourself every decade to sort of blow things up and start all over again. You know, you got something really, really strong that you keep coming back to. You know, and there's lots of teams I've worked with that are like that. They do lose their way from time to time, but they got something very powerful that actually anchors them. And often when they're not doing well, it's because that they've drifted away from that. So be very intentional around the story that you want to create. Don't just be technical, tactical, structural. Make sure you've got a good narrative beside it and that you are building the culture in the optimal way right from the start.
And I felt it when you were telling your story, that sort of almost opening up of energy and that embodied sense of what storytelling offers. You can feel it. And you know, a lot of our clients talk about time. And it might be a myth, but, you know, in schools, time is very structured. And what you said there about the drift, you know, you might have created your origin story, but how do you breathe life into it? You mentioned ritual. What have you seen where people really keep this alive?
Well, it's funny. I've done some workshops with schools and trusts this year. And I ask some basic questions sometimes, you know, how do you define success? And it's quite depressing how often the answer is, you know, ticking boxes, being compliant, getting stuff done for external approval. And my check on that is, and this comes back to your point about energy, is when we reframe it and we say, okay, let's actually think about, you're not allowed to think about Ofsted or KPIs or anything, okay? You're prevented from doing that in this conversation, this workshop. So this is the question. I want you to articulate the identity of your school based on the story so far. And now I want you to tell me the story, the chapter of the story that you're going to write right now together with your colleagues. So just a reframing of the same basic question of why are we here for and what does success actually look like? And I tell you what, that the energy you get in reframing the question is unreal. It's as good as in a sports team. People love it. They become animated. They really have amazing eye contact and they get into it. And then they're really proud. And, you know, the feedback is, you know, strong around we actually started to visualize what a successful school would look like. And it's not just, you know, some external person's approval. It's actually the way our children are, their well-being, the connection with their community, the springboard into the rest of their lives, the alumni, how that is back and still they feel they belong to the school years and decades after they've been here, all of these things. So I think that, you know, that's important. I do that with sports teams every single year. Because every year we get, in every academic year, is a new chapter of the story. So creating a ritual where we always make time to go away together and review where we are, including what needs to be addressed, and then previewing the chapter of the story that we want to write together. So that's an important part of it. And then a lot of things can be done in terms of rituals, et cetera, you know, inductions when people come in, when a new teacher comes in, induct them in a way which is actually good for everybody because it reinforces who we are and what we believe in, plus creates a space for them to tell a little bit about their story so we connect with each other. But I think the real key is it's all very well to do things like that, but it's the day-to-day experience of making people feel they belong. That is what the great leaders and the great environments do. It's not a once in a year thing. It's every day. I give an example sometimes. Someone like Gareth Southgate, when he's giving feedback to a player, may not be, you know, may be challenging feedback for a player. But the way he will do it is before he gives the feedback, he would say to the player, let's just talk about how you're performing right now. Before we get into the conversation, I just want to remind you, this is why you belong here. This is why I select you to play for England. this is what I love about you as a person, as a teammate, as a footballer. And then he also will reference, you know, remember the conversation we had before the season, and we spoke about the growth that you've got in you and this vision of what you could become, the best version of you. And again, as a person, as a teammate, as a player, remember we spoke, and he's done it, you know, and often he'll do it at their club, even their houses. So yeah, these are genuine things. And then he will say, you just talk to me, my friend, what's the gap you feel there is between how you're performing right now and that vision of the best version of yourself? Now, when you have leaders who are able to have conversations with you framed like that, that doesn't feel transactional, and that doesn't feel like you're going to get removed from there in 5 minutes. It feels like someone actually cares about you and that their plan at least, and obviously in high-performance sport it's all subject to selection, but their plan at least is that you will grow and that you will stay there. And, you know, even when you go, you know that that relationship and that experience will be with you for the rest of your life. So those day-to-day things are really, really important. You know, I remember when we relocated to the UK from New Zealand, my daughter, who was only 5, she was the class leader in her nursery in Auckland. You know, she's very sociable and very effervescent and very energetic and everything. And when she came actually to this primary school, she became a complete introvert, even to the point where the teachers told us that she's a little bit concerned about her. But what had happened is that she was moved to the other side of the world, didn't know the culture, the people, the school, anything. We just literally the day after we arrived, she started school, and the teacher didn't make any space to connect her to where she was or connect her to the other people in the class. She just said, there's a new girl, Olivia, starting today, and then put her at sort of end of a desk at the back of the room. And she had an anxiety around it, which just stayed with her the whole year. So there was no signaling that you belong here. It was that actually you don't. You've got a different accent. You've come from a different place. You don't belong here. You sit in the back row of the classroom. So these things are, you know, when I get into an environment, you're really looking at a lot of not just verbal signals of belonging, but nonverbal, body language, tone, how configuration, how much people do work in groups versus just the big open sort of classroom environment that has a big effect on how people feel included in things, especially people from cultures where you're not really encouraged to speak up. So, yeah, those day-to-day signals are massive.
My reflection on that, just hearing you speak, Owen, maybe a bit bleak, but just connecting the two bits, I was like, sense that it's feeling like us, our ancestors or other cultures maybe other soldiers that exist are really good at this and get it. And yet somehow, you know, just describing your daughter's situation there, like how have we created cultures in schools or elsewhere that it means we've got so bad at it? Because when you dissect it in the way that you have and you do, like, there's nothing rocket science here, is there? There's nothing hugely complex or difficult to implement.
No. You know, we had a really tragic example at our high school here in the last few weeks, actually, so my son goes to the local high school and there's a car traveling after school and with 4 children, and it had a horrendous car accident and 3 of the children were killed, and it was only a few weeks ago. It's really devastated our community. You wouldn't be surprised to know. And the week before that, I actually gave a talk at the school. And one of the points I was making was that our ancestors didn't regard resilience as a superhero quality that some people had and some people didn't. And that's, you know, we have become much more individualistic as a society. And there's this idea that, you know, are you a resilient person? These are all the things. Our ancestors understood that resilience actually was a reflection of being part of a group of people where you felt you belonged and you trusted each other and you could navigate adversity together. You know, again, there's nothing, as he said, Matt, there's no rocket science in that. And actually, after this tragedy at the school, what was interesting was the school welcomed everybody to come into the school on the Sunday, a couple of days after this happened. They did incredible pastoral care for the whole of the school to understand and go through this experience together. The community were invited into the school to be part of this. And everybody commented on that this felt like something that people couldn't navigate, but actually we're able to work through it together. Now, obviously, the families are in a different category altogether. But for the rest of the community, and, you know, I sent the school message and just said, like, couldn't believe there would be a better demonstration of my point last week, which was that resilience is a reflection on the groups of people we belong to and how strong they are and how much we trust them. You know, it wasn't left for every individual to try and deal with this appalling thing. We did it together, and we did it with some good leadership.
Yeah, devastating story and also extraordinary leadership, like you say. And I'm listening to you, it feels like leaders, it's their role to create the environment, like you say, but people actually intuitively know how to be with each other in a, is that too naive to say that it's the leader that creates the environment? But then people, if it's wired into us, then if it's a safe space, we know what to do. Those people knew how to grieve together.
I'm really glad you've asked that question, because this probably touches upon the thing that I feel most strongly about. There is a global mental health report, which is annual. It's out of New York. There's 178 countries surveyed. 300,000 people around the world are interviewed. And the global mental health report has shown that over the last 2 or 3 years, the most significant mental deterioration has happened with 16 to 24-year-olds across the world. So this is not just Western countries, this is globally. And sitting underneath that, when they've interviewed them to understand why, is that that age group, there is I think it was 47% last year, reported that they were suffering mental trauma during the course of that year. Again, when they tried to understand why, the number one reason was a loss of social self. What that means is people feeling chronically lonely and isolated from others, and a real lack of belonging to genuine, authentic groups of human beings. Obviously, the social media and all that is they belong to those groups, but that leaves a massive hollowness and emptiness in people. And that, you know, should scare everybody, scares me massively. Now, when we think about that, what I think as well is that where do people in their lives now get a profound sense of belonging? Now, you'd hope to say family, but actually a lot of people come from dysfunctional families where actually it's not really that sense of belonging. The second place would be school, I think, and then the third place would be probably workplace later in life, which is not famous for giving people sense of belonging or feeling included. So to me, we are now completely reliant on our well-being of the next few generations to schools, because if children don't get that sense of belonging and well-being from schools, there's a real risk they won't get it from anywhere else in their lives. And, you know, the idea that school sports is falling away as well scares, you know, me massively, because I don't care about school sports in terms of winning a trophy. I care about it. It's an experience where you are part of a team, and if it's done properly, you feel like you learn how to belong to with people. You learn how to be disappointed with people. You learn how to go to adversity with people. You learn how to celebrate with people. You know how to share things with people. So to me, this is school. We're 100% reliant on you now. For the well-being of our children, we have to provide them with places where they experience this fundamental human need to belong and be included. And once they've experienced it in school, what excites me is they then have a frame of reference for the rest of their lives. When they go into other groups in their community and into workplaces, if you've experienced what a great environment is like, then you've got something to compare and to navigate with. But if you've never had that, We're gonna go even worse in the opposite direction, aren't we? So no pressure, but schools, I'm 100%. All my chips are on you.
Well, with that in mind, that takes me to the question, which I always don the shoes of the principal listening to this and say, hey, hold on a second, Owen. Yeah, like easier said than done, right? So I've got this 2,000 kids, 250 staff. I'm facing the challenge of post-pandemic world where the value of school has been questioned, like kids have realized they can do 2 years without going into the building. I've got the challenge of them being on their phone and being connected to each other in a different, less direct way. And I hear you, I absolutely hear you, and I'm totally signed up, but curious as to the how, because it feels harder than ever with the distraction of technology and the intervention of technology and the kind of collapse potentially of institutions as being the trustworthy source of where we should, gather around. So I'm with you. I think school should be that. But if I'm asking you this as the principal who's feeling like school is the answer to everything already, but maybe can't take one more thing, help me out here.
Yeah. Okay. Well, I'll reassure them that actually it's not hard. It's just purely an intent. It's not resource heavy. It should not be disruptive. It should be natural. So first thing we will do, number one, is make sure that you have a strong story of who you are as a school that people can belong to. It's all very well to say people have a sense of belonging, but belonging to what? And if you actually, if this is all about exams and classrooms and schedules and timetables, okay, that's not a narrative that I belong to. You need to understand, say, what is the origins, what is our history of our school, what are our values, what are the stories that are our values are wrapped in. I want you to do some good storytelling, principal, okay? And then I can attach my belonging to that. So you need to do that. And some schools I've seen are unbelievable, exceptional, beautiful the way they do it, like world class. And then and a lot of people, there's nothing. There's nothing. So that's where we can all raise our game. The second thing I would do is people are able to attach a sense of belonging much more easily when they have a good sense of their own identity. So there is a school in New Zealand that I spoke with, a rural school, country school. And for 12-year-olds, and now I've started to see this replicated because I've been talking about it a bit and a few people are adopting this, for their 12-year-olds, year seven or whatever, the first 3 months, they curate with every individual, every student, their own identity story. So they talk to their parents to find out a little bit more about where they come from and where their ancestors come from. If they've got grandparents around, they speak to them. They take the kids on the bus to the local wharf and to the harbour to explain the local history. So they do all of these things and they get a historian to come in and show them on, how you on your screen, you can go in and look back and find really interesting information on your ancestors. And, you might not know your grandfather's name, but actually we'll find it in 10 seconds here. Here we go. So they just create, it's nothing prescriptive. They create this environment for children to start exploring who they are. And what happens is that the climax of it isn't that every student stands up and tells their whole family story or their own personal story. That is not the climax. The climax of it is each child does articulate to their class, these are the values I want to live my life by, and these are where they come from. And you get children talking about, maybe resilience because their grandparents were refugees who came to the country and didn't speak the language and gave up a lot. People talking about kindness because their grandmother had cancer but just never stopped smiling and was always kind in everything she did. So these children, but I also understand that they are part, if they're from New Zealand, then they'll have some other ancestry. So they start to, in their mind, belong to these wider groups. So you don't have to be active with them. As a 12-year-old, I felt I belonged to the Maori and the English and the Irish. Didn't physically belong there. I wasn't with them, but in my mind, I was very, very filled up with belonging. So I think that's something that schools, I would make that compulsory. And I know some New Zealand schools are moving towards that we will create the environment because it's not as obvious as it was when we all lived in the same village, went to the same church, played for the same teams. It's different. So they can go have their social media groups. That's not going to change. That's fine. But they will be anchored in a sense of who they are and where they belong beyond these things. So that's the second thing I would do. And I actually think, I've done that with sports teams and it's very powerful. And it's a legacy that they take with the rest of their lives. Thirdly, create a space where children are able to share bits of their own story with teachers and also with each other. It's hard to feel you belong if people don't really understand your story. It's interesting, someone like Gareth Southgate, a lot of football coaches don't want to know anything really about someone's past, present. you know, really, while other coaches are very relational and do. So if you're not playing very well and you're struggling, but a coach knows that you've got a child who is very ill, that makes a complete difference to how you feel about that environment, how transactional versus how much belonging. So I think understanding the story behind people is important and making a space for that, getting to know a bit about them. And then the final thing is what I said is the day-to-day experience. So whether there needs to be educational mandates for teachers, but even like I gave an example before about how you give feedback, you can give feedback in a way which doesn't give a sense of belonging, gives the opposite. And I remember as a partner in a law firm, I would give very matter-of-fact feedback to junior lawyers. And I know actually in reflection, they would, some of them would think, you know what I just heard from him was, if I keep doing this, I'll be sacked. So that was dumb on my part, but I was uneducated. I didn't really know how to create that experience and feeling. So I think there's, you know, and I get so much warmth from teachers when I'm speaking around and doing workshops around, we want to teach like that. We want to teach like that. We want to make them feel included. And even, you know, I did some work with the Royal Ballet School in London, and it was very interesting, very, very traditional in many ways. But actually, this new generation of teachers, at the start, to create a sense of inclusion, they would breathe together before they started the class, just to get into a rhythm and to be calm. And then the teacher would ask them, you know where we are in our rehearsals. What would you like to focus on today? To like 11, 12-year-olds. Now, that's super smart teaching, but, you know, you can't do that every day, but some days you can do that, and that gives a real powerful sense of inclusion when someone is asking you the question, how do you think we should go about this stuff? So those things are critical. You've got to get that right. So I think I don't think anything there blows up the way a school is doing things. It's just a matter of emphasis to me.
Yeah, it really is. Go ahead, Naomi.
Thank you so much, Owen, for that map. Actually, from that macro to the micro interactions. And what was coming up for me was, what a source of joy for the leader who's creating that, and the quality of those interactions, because it comes back to you, doesn't it, if you are able to create that. So I imagine people are already thinking through how some of this is possible. Yeah.
Yeah, I don't claim it's easy. I understand when, you know, I know my own experiences, it can be children who are very disruptive who will, you know, for whatever reason, not be buying into creating the most positive environment, and they've got to be addressed. I don't, you know, and the environments I work in, we don't really have to deal with that, very occasionally, but not really. I understand that. Those people also need to have their own sense of belonging as well, even though they may be disruptive. So I understand it's not easy. But our ancestors did a very, very good job at it. And what I think is, it's keep locked into these simple ideas. You know, I don't, in my book, Belonging, and I've had people comment on it, I don't write a prescription at the end of each chapter, these are the 10 things you need to do. The principles are very, very simple. They've been repeated all the way down. We've all experienced the good and the bad. So you figure out for yourself, you know, how you want to do this. So just keep it as simple as possible.
What comes to mind as you're talking is, you know, MSB, we think about leadership in the kind of three sectors of being, doing, thinking, and how often leaders get understandably hijacked by doing. Like, we need to do stuff, which you touched upon earlier, we need to do. But actually sounds like the art of this in the map that you've outlined for us is really around being. What are the behaviors? How do I create the space? And actually it's more about doing less in lots of ways. You know, how do we turn away from those extrinsic motivators and find the intrinsic ones?
I mean, the three of us are coaches, and I would say head teachers, principals are coaches as well. Mm. So the way I think about coaching is that we've got an obligation to really provide two things to our people. One is we need to energize them. And secondly, we need to provide critical thinking. And both of those are done within the context of genuinely caring about them. That's how I approach coaching. So I think as you evolve or maybe reconnect to these cultures of belonging, to me, hopefully what's come across in our conversation today is this is really energizing. If for every human being. Okay, we're wired this way. We are desperate for it. We're seeking it. We feel hollow and empty when we don't experience these things. So we can energize people in a profound way. Okay. And there has to be some critical thinking about comparing that experience versus maybe some of the habits we've got into through a lot of probably external interference over time, which has distorted the environment. So those two things together, I think we can definitely get there.
So I guess as we come to the end of what's been just a fab conversation, Owen, I'm curious, let's find the real positives. Where have you seen belonging done kind of, you know, like world class? Team, company, setting, school. I'm just curious about your experience of what it's looked like, felt like when you've just seen it, like these guys are all over it. They know exactly what they're doing.
Well, it's quite hard to answer that because it's inherent in all the work that I do. Is everywhere I go, we will create that environment. And often I'm only invited in because it's lacking in the first place. but actually to answer your question, probably with the most satisfying personal experience I've had actually was when my son was primary school in New Zealand. He was, I think, 8 or 9. He loved basketball, but they didn't have any parents who could sort of help out with the under-9s basketball team. So I put my hand up and said, I'll do that. I wasn't coaching them. I was managing them. So they'd play every Wednesday afternoon after school against other schools. And what was interesting was there was 8 kids in the team, half of which hadn't been born in New Zealand. 3 of them were Korean, who didn't speak a lot of English really. They'd only come over in the last few years. One boy had come from Serbia during that civil war, or his parents had come during that civil war period. My son was born in England, but, you know, half Kiwi. And so a very, very diverse group of kids. And they were so standing back all the time. They didn't, none of them felt they belonged even to the school, the community, the basketball team. So nervous. And then one kid who was quite talented was quite selfish because he saw that this is all about me, not us, really. I mean, I just want to get the most out of this I can and get into a better team next year. And, you know, it was, and we were terrible, absolutely terrible. So I thought, okay, you know what? I need to apply these principles, you know, we use in international sport into this. So we actually just created a space where we would form these huddles and we would get all of the kids just to talk, not give their life story necessarily, but just to talk and ask them. I asked them, what do you love about playing basketball? How do you feel about playing for your school? And just started to engender a bit of a sense that they belong to something bigger than themselves and give them the respect. So not favoring anybody. And everything we did was all together. I enforced this playing style, which was that we all had to pass the ball to each other and wasn't a matter of anybody being selfish. And it was just wonderful seeing these kids, and the Korean kids in particular, just for the first time felt probably like a Kiwi, felt they belonged. And my goodness, the way they improved was sensational. And we ended up going on this incredible run and making the finals of the same group of kids. It was nothing, there was no talent, and I couldn't coach them. It was literally nothing to do with me. But the environment changed completely where they were so anxious and in themselves and scared to take a risk and scared of criticism, to being able to relax and have a bit of dopamine and oxytocin pumping through their system where they felt they could trust the people around them. They could trust me. I never shouted at anyone. I just smiled at them. They knew that. I was never they could trust me completely. The parents got involved. They would, you know. So that it was. And at the end of it, I actually even use that photo of that team now when I'm doing sort of so-called big speaking events, just to show that that is a really pure story of belonging and how that profoundly affects, again, the performance of people but also the well-being of people. So if I could do it with a bunch of 8-year-old boys, I think, you know, there's hope for all of us.
Owen, thanks so much for your time today. If people want to find out more about your work, I mean, it's obvious where to find your book. Every good bookshop, I'd really recommend it. But if people want to find out about your wider work, where do we go?
I'm a bit inconsistent on social media, depending on how busy I am on projects. But on LinkedIn is the best place, and I post things from time to time there, and people comment on the book and other things.
Great. Thanks so much.
Thank you for coming along with us on this principal journey. To learn more about making stuff better and how we can help you and leaders in your school, please do get in touch through hello@makingstuffbetter.com. Alternatively, you can find us in all the usual places like LinkedIn, Twitter, and Facebook. Links are in the show notes below. And don't forget to subscribe, and if you can, leave us a review. That's all for now. See you next time.